Thanks, Al. I've had the pleasure to go out on the Find and Treat van, not today, on another occasion. It's a very good experience, and it shows the marriage, I think, of the kind of the human and the relationship side with the technology and how that comes together to provide that service and that innovation. But before I ramble on anymore, it's time to open up the floor to questions. There's one at the back, Maxi. Should we take like three at a time? Because we've got a few, so.
Hi, so yeah, Maxine Radcliffe. I'm actually asking this in my capacity as a governing body member of Central London CCG, which is one of the joint lead commissioners for the Pan London programme. And you had a rather turgid talk about it earlier. Al and Dave, we have an opportunity to commission services Pan London. What would you like to see happen?
Any more?
You spoke earlier about the psychoactive substances. A lot that I'm hearing recently is people experiencing withdrawal symptoms very similar to heroin. What do you know about that, and is there anything that you've come across to prevent that, or how to manage that while they're experiencing it?
Have we got one more? No? Should we go with those? Oh, one more here.
Hello, Caroline Barley from North East Lincolnshire. That's Grimsby, Cleethorpes, Hemingham, and the film that you all keep hearing about, that there's got no truth to it at all. Just a simple question, really. Is there anything, it's my naivety really, is there anything that's stopping services going into the hostels to test for Hep B and C?
Okay, should we start? David, should we start around, can we start around MPS and withdrawal symptoms management?
Yes, I think so. Well, I'll try. So what's really interesting about spice use, which you might remember from the slide, is that actually the effects you get from it are not cannabis-like. You know, if you've worked with cannabis, if you're familiar with cannabis, then you'll see they're not that at all. In fact, the presentation tends to be much more stimulant-like. So you get agitation, you get sweating, you get that kind of thing, rather than being opiate-like. So you don't get central nervous system depressant and stuff. But what we are seeing among people are, one, people reporting withdrawal symptoms, that they wake up in the morning and they have to have it. Not in the way that opiate withdrawals come on, as in they get increasingly harder to resist, you feel worse and worse and worse, you want to do something to ameliorate that. But much more like alcohol, you wake up in the morning and you have a panic and you have to have it. So what's interesting is that the profile doesn't look opiate related at all, but we do get a lot of heroin users who historically have been heroin injectors, heroin users, who no longer use. They've detoxed themselves off heroin, and all they do now is smoke spice. And we've also had some of our alcohol-dependent clients, not so many, also saying that they've been able to detox themselves from alcohol by just smoking loads and loads of spice. And I'm not really sure what the mechanism is. So with stimulants, you don't generally get a withdrawal syndrome as such. What you get is the hangover from taking lots of stimulants and staying up and not eating and not sleeping and not drinking and burning up all your serotonin, your adrenaline, and so on and so on and so on. So you get an absence, you get a hangover, but you don't get withdrawals as such because there's no fundamental change to how the brain works. It doesn't adapt structurally to accommodate the drug in the way that it does for alcohol or heroin. But it's really hard to work out. I don't really know what the pharmacology is. I don't know what the mechanism is. There's some suggestions that there is some overlap and there is some opiate receptor activity. It's not the primary effect, but there's enough to allow people to detox. So I think when you look at withdrawals, it's about managing symptoms. So even if you're not certain what the cause is, I think it's about managing what's happening for that person. So opiate withdrawals, as you probably know, are horrible. You might wish you were going to die, you might think you're going to die, but you won't. But withdrawals from alcohol or benzodiazepines or GHB are actually quite life-threatening for some people. So it's about managing what's going on. What we do see from people with spice is they often get uncontrolled shaking, get very anxious, you get lots of rebound stuff. I'm not certain, I don't know, please correct me if you do know, but I'm not certain that any of that is life-threatening in itself, but it's obviously very unpleasant. So I think if you've got somebody who you may have a raging temperature, somebody who is incoherent or not certain where they are, disorientated, then I think you need to manage that. So it's much more akin to managing stimulant, people who had too much stimulants, I think. So my approach would generally be that can you calm them down? You know, can they just, if they sit quietly, does it wear off? Or do they need medical treatment? I'm not aware that people need to go to A&E with spice withdrawals. But you might know, there'll be people who see a lot more spices than I do, so please chip in.
Oh, sorry, can you just wait for the mic?
Oh, sorry, yeah.
So you can get on film.
About a year ago, I was in a hostel in Bristol. There were 70 residents and about 4 regular users of spice. Late last year, I was in Norwich in a hostel. There were 30 residents, well over 50% of them using spice. It's akin to smoking ketamine. It's that fast and it's that you are out of it immediately. We recently had a guy, someone gave him a pipe of it. He didn't realize what it was. He started to show almost fitting. He fell off a wall. He was in complete panic. And it's very hard to communicate with someone who's on spice, but it doesn't actually last that long. 20 minutes, and you know, they sort of, they'll be more coherent. But you just need to try and keep them calm. There are recorded deaths of it. I've done drugs for well over 30 years, and this is by far the most frightening thing I've seen. I won't go near it, and I'm seeing so many people take it now. If it's not where you are now, it'll be there soon. Because what they're doing, they're closing down the shops that sell it, but those guys are then doing an out-of-hours service, delivering it to people. And where we are, someone gets on the train, goes to Norwich, spends their entire benefit check on it, comes back, sells it for twice the price, and they sell it in minutes. He comes back with 20, 25 packets, it's gone like that, people are waiting for it. He can go again the same day and get the same. People just want more and more and more, and it's going to be a huge problem.
Thank you.
I was just going to add that in Bristol, the specialist drug team are now offering an alcohol detox with basically a straightforward Librium detox for the people who are addicted to spice, and that does seem to be quite successful.
Thanks for that. Okay, so I'm going to go back to front on the questions we were asked. So is there anything stopping services testing Hep B and C in hostels? Al, do you want to come in on that?
Well, I mean, there's not a lot of cash out there to actually promote outreach, I've seen. There's some great examples, there's some really good examples of people who do get out and do test. I wouldn't say it was just Hep B and C that we were looking at. You know, back to my gripe about a pathogen-specific approach. I mean, if you're going to take the trouble of getting out, trekking across town, getting face-to-face with someone, do you want to arrive with, you know, just one badge at the end of the day? I'm acutely aware of the fact that, you know, we do people a huge disservice by just doing one thing at a time. And we've got to build on that opportunity of encounter. And if you're able to take a full one-stop shop approach, as it were, to take the technologies necessary to cover as many bases as possible in a really nice environment that's welcoming, that's accessible, and provide the onward care, then I think that should be the approach. And I have no problem with innovative services that want to get out there and outreach and test for Hep C in the community. But if you're going to make a hole in someone, for God's sake, you know, I mean, let's just test them for more than one thing. Now, getting venous access can be quite hard in some people. They're quite, you know, they don't want to be a pincushion. So let's get together, let's think about how we can actually provide a service around the person rather than our specific interests in bugs.
Megan, you wanted to say something?
I'm incredibly lucky in the hospital that I work in that we've got close links to our homeless GP surgery. And we're even more lucky to have our doctor sat at the back of the room, waving to Henry. And I was hoping that he might be able to add a little bit as well. But I do know that you and our nurse, or your nurse, not my nurse, I used to work there, sorry, really confusing. But the nurse come and visit the hostel. And I don't know about testing whether you come, but you do come and see our clients because I've obviously sat in with you with our clients. So perhaps you would like to add. Oh, Henry, no. Oh, wait for the microphone, see?
So, one of the nurses, I think, visits every week or every other week and does blood-borne virus testing in the hospital. And then in the capacity of a GP, I go there once a month. And see patients who aren't able to come into clinic to see us. So in terms of local services in Norwich, I think we do have fairly good coverage of at least some of the hospitals doing BVV screening.
Just to be contentious, because I usually aren't, the work in London has really shifted away from building-based services. We've lost 1 in 4 of the beds in London. The frontline statutory sector has been hammered. And our work is increasingly on the street, and they are a population that are really invisible and certainly not engaged with primary care services. And the classic inverse care relationship is there, and the detection rate, the prevalence, the health need within that population is measurably greater than it is, obviously should be, measurably greater than it is in populations who have been able to get into a hostel, who are increasingly becoming the minority. Mm. Get into the hostels, provide care, support people, but take to the street.
And that leads nicely onto the London question that we had to start with, which Maxine's been waiting very patiently for an answer from. So obviously London has the highest rate of TB in Western Europe and in some of the other poorer parts of the world. And obviously a high and growing rate of homelessness. David, did you want to say what you'd like to see happen in London, here in London, commissioning-wise?
I know Maxine quite well, and generally what I've learned from experience is that whatever Maxine says is generally the thing you want to do. So I'm not sure I can add anything that you wouldn't know, but I think one thing that's become apparent is that there's a lack of joining up of services, and I think the Pan London Commissioning is exactly the way forward, because you've got a transient population, so they're never in the same borough for very long, for various reasons, but also in that pathway through services, the point where they're coming in and out of hospital, hence the pathway teams, the points where they're changing between services. I used to work in a service that was the other end of the road from Maxine's. We would do the prescribing, they would do the primary care, and we tried to work together, but there's a gap, there's still distance. So I think it's about not just geographical joined up working, but a kind of linear joined up working, and something that supports that and sees all the services along that chain as having equal importance and getting on And that's actually one thing that commissioners can make us do, I think. It might not be a bad thing. It's easy to sit in a room thinking, I'm the NHS and you're all going to do what I say. I've spent a long time working with third sector services. I know that, one, they don't do what you say, but two, actually, it's really important. It's a hugely important part of this work that we do, that we all take each other seriously. And one of the things that I saw from the work with the pathway team at UCH is how everybody is taken seriously. It's a big, multidisciplinary, interagency team meeting, and everybody who represents that is taken very seriously, because that's the only way it works. So I guess it's that joined up equality thing. Yeah.
Can you just finish us off with one sort of final comment on that question?
I mean, if it's Christmas, I'll just wish for, I'll get my wand out. I mean, reality is, I think we need to be a bit more ambitious. We're familiar with the work of Susan Fitzpatrick. We know the roots into homelessness. We've heard this morning an inspirational lecture from Richard Wilkinson, which basically clearly explains that, you know, homelessness is complex, but, you know, quite fundamentally, it's a kind of becoming an acceptable waste product of the inequalities, the gross inequalities that we've learned and grown to tolerate. So let's look outside of this box, or perhaps get it back into the box. Let's do something a bit more obvious. When I look over at the work that's gone on in the Netherlands, for instance, and I see their ambition not to just end rough sleeping, which is a nonsense statement in itself, I see their strategy to end homelessness, and I see their more whole system approach to bring together issues around life opportunity, issues around housing, issues around employment, access to meaningful work, and I see success. And you know, we've got to raise the bar. I mean, health is a major issue, sure, but you know, homelessness is not an insurmountable and tolerable thing. It should be quite simply defined as a state, not a trait, and it should be something that we work together for a more sort of imaginative and whole systems approach, which can be done in the style of the Dutch and many other centres, to actually think about trying to prevent it ever happening rather than pick up the pieces, which is a frustrating and too often a thankless task.
Thank you very much, Al. I think that links very nicely to the warming the water approach of Scotland that we heard earlier. I've got to wrap it up now because we're running out of time, but thank you so much for your participation and your questions, and thanks to Al and David for their really informative presentations, and to Megan for her contributing as well. So have a good kind of rest of session if you're staying on. Come to our Q&A stand if you haven't already, just the final plug, and thanks again. Cheers.
Thank you.